Hi, this is Dave at thenewyorkbudget.com, and when I'm not breakdancing on the subway for money, I'm stacking Benjamins.
Live from the place where we're building an ice cream and money empire, it's the Stacking Benjamin Show. Everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and it's time for me to buy an ice cream truck to make my fortune. Isn't that how all the robber barons did it back in the day? But the wallet's a little empty right now, which seems unfair. So today, to help us work through better ways to save money, professor at the University of Chicago Law School, William Birdthistle. That is the most awesome name I have ever heard. Oh my God. Also, headlines about another financial advisory firm shutting down, a Quotacy hotline call, your letters, and more. And here they are, two guys who'd better get this podcast trucking, and I don't mean ice cream trucking, Joe and O-J-J-J-J-G.
When you think of going trucking, you just kind of think of those flaps on the back of the big rigs, you know, that have like the silhouettes of the ladies that says keep trucking, and you got Alabama playing in the background.
I think that the fact that Doug just asked you and I for money for this venture of his, I hope he goes to Alabama or further. Hey, everybody, I'm Joe Salcihi, Average Joe Money on Twitter. And man, do we have a fantastic show today, regardless of what's going on with Doug. We've got Professor William Birdthistle, Irish gentlemen coming down to the basement, OG.
A dynamite.
That's something totally different. Hello, Australia. You're only half the world away. Hey, you know what? You could be half the world away, but you could still reach, which is stackybenjamins.com/magnified money. How about that, huh? No matter where on the world you are, if you head to stackybenjamins.com/magnified money, what you'll find is that checking account, the savings account, and the debt products you're using might not be the best ones. So if you head to stackybenjamins.com/magnified money, Nick Bryan and the team have set up this amazing website where over 92% of the products available, they help you look at them and you can stay anonymous the whole time. While you're anonymous, you know what you're going to find? You're going to find that, guess what? Best debt products out there, especially for people with good credit, stackybenjamins.com/SOFI, spelled S-O-F-I. They're the leader in marketplace lending. And what does that mean? You got a student loan at a high interest rate? Bam! You got these personal debts that you want to consolidate into a lower interest rate debt and have only one loan? Bam! Got it. Have a mortgage? Boom! StackingBenjamins.com/SOFI. Fantastic. All right. Speaking of fantastic, we got a fantastic show, OG. We got Professor Birdthistle upstairs talking to mom. And, you know, she doesn't even care what he's saying. She's like, can you just keep talking? Please.
He's so dreamy.
Just keep talking. But first, headlines.
Hello, darlings. And now it's time for your favorite part of the show, our Stacking Benjamins headlines.
I don't know which one of these is a bigger headline, so we're going to start with this one from Investment News. Liebenthal shutters Wealth Management Group. The division opened its doors at the start of 2014, but failed to gain traction in the shifting advice marketplace. This is a piece by Bruce Kelly. So this place only started in 2014, OG, and at its peak in the last, year and a half, it had close to $950 million dollars in assets under management.
Not quite enough to keep the firm open though, huh?
Yeah, here's what happened. A team with $750 million decided to leave in June, and then the wheels came off the bus. But it's amazing. You know, they talk about shifting advisor landscape, and that was the key that made me want to talk about this, was that this should be an easy time to market, looking at how silly people are, and they put money in stocks at the wrong time. Like, the market has just gone up and up and up and up. It seems like this would be a difficult time for a firm to shutter.
Oh, you're saying that it's odd that they're closing up because the market seems to be doing so well.
Yeah, they couldn't find their niche in the shifting advisory marketplace.
Yeah, so kind of the backstory with this is that this was not a RIA firm to begin with. And that's lingo in our business, but an advisory firm. It originally was a bond firm. What happened a couple of years ago was they looked at it and said, well, we can compete in the aggregator advisor space. And there's a lot of advisory firms out there that their job is to bring all sorts of other advisors together under the same umbrella, and you get some economies of scale that way. But then it also kind of, you can kind of puff your chest out a little bit and say, well, we manage $1 billion. It's like, okay, it's not one group though. It's 10 different groups that each manage 100 million, you know, or something like that. And the thing that they lacked was the capital to acquire those businesses when other companies were offering big
incentives. Yeah, to come on board.
Sometimes it can be hundreds of thousands and even millions of dollars of signing bonuses to the head honcho at a firm to change from one to the other. And I think they just couldn't compete with that.
Well, there's an interesting line in here that Mr. Kelly writes. The closing of Liebenthal Wealth Advisors comes at a time when common wisdom in the securities industry is that small and mid-sized firms are facing extinction-like pressures, rising compliance costs, and creating a distinct profile in a crowded market are two such burdens. Gain scale or go home is a common refrain among industry professionals. You seeing that?
I can see how people would tout that, especially if they were on that aggregator side of the business. But I don't think that that small and mid-sized firm is going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I mean, some of the advisors have been on the show. Just seems like their businesses are growing. They're very healthy, but it just seems to be quality of advice and good marketing. You know,
it boils down to.
I don't get it. Have you seen compliance costs going up?
Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah,
probably tenfold. And accelerating even faster.
That's scary. Here's something else scary. This is from Barron's magazine. This is a shocker. Vanguard bucks a trend. You know what Vanguard's doing, OG?
I do know. So let's hear it.
They have just registered for a transparent, active U.S. ETF. So exchange-traded funds, passive investments. Vanguard, the king of passive investing, has said, we want to get on in this active thing. According to Johanna Bennett, Vanguard Group wants to enter the actively managed ETF market in the United States. The firm that built an empire on low-cost passive investing with both mutual funds and exchange-traded funds has asked the SEC for permission to market exchange-traded funds that are run by stock and bond pickers with portfolios that would be disclosed daily.
I'm dumbfounded. When I read this the other day on the internet, I
was so surprised. I'm like, yeah. They're doing what?
Yeah.
That just doesn't seem to be something that they would do. So let's talk about why they would. First of all, an exchange-traded fund versus a mutual fund. You know, for some of our listeners, maybe we need to start there. Exchange-traded fund traditionally is what, OG?
It's going to be a little bit more liquid, right? So an exchange-traded fund generally is something that at a certain point in time every year matches what the index is. So you might have an exchange-traded fund that's supposed to match the S&P 500, for example. And on whatever day their reconstitution day is, June 30th, it will look exactly like the S&P in terms of its weighting and in terms of its positions. That changes throughout the year, of course, as companies are added and subtracted from that index. The idea behind an ETF is that while it's priced daily, minute by minute, and you can trade in and out of it, it just was kind of designed to be representative of what the market would be.
Yeah, and you still get diversification. Which is nice, but it trades like an individual stock.
Yep. It trades like an individual stock. You know, you still don't want to jump in and out of it, but you have the ability to do that.
So the whole idea about exchange traded funds, so they are these funds that kind of match the return of an exchange minus what the fee is, right?
Yeah. In theory, that's exactly how it should work.
But it's not anymore. Now, all of a sudden, we've got this sexy, I'm going to put an advisor in there. And they're going to start
trading. So mutual funds, on the other hand, generally speaking, are managed by a person. And the theory with actively managed mutual funds is that if I was an active manager of a mutual fund, my philosophy is that I can pick the next winners of the stocks better than just owning all the stocks. And that's how I pay for myself and my fee, which is a little bit higher or 10 times higher than an index fund. And I have got some sort of cool calculation system, math program, algorithm trading software that tells me when to buy and sell. And that's how I provide value if I was an active manager, which I'm not, but in case I was. But all the research has shown time and 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 time again. I was talking to a client about this earlier, 5 minutes before we walked down to the basement, that not only historically do people not beat the market, which is the first strike, right? Historically, no one beats the market, and certainly they don't do it over a long period of time. Even if they do, here's the second strike. You can't pick that guy in advance because there's no statistical evidence to be able to show that he's going to be the or she's going to be the one that's going to do it in advance.
And yeah, because when they've done it, they never replicate the success.
Because it's not replicatable. Right. It's random. That's why. There is no statistical evidence of the persistence of performance.
Good day to Professor Bert Thistle here because, you know, you and I are insinuating it's a shell game. He's going to tell you point blank.
He's not
going to
insinuate.
He's not going to insinuate anything. I think our lessons, we'll leave that lesson for Professor Bert Thistle, but we'll go a little lightly. Active managed funds, Vanguard, maybe reaching into the cookie jar a little bit. Hmm?
I think so.
And then the second, so what, firm shutting down because of compliance cost? Maybe there's some other reasons. Professor William Bert Thistle, professor of law at University of Chicago, a little school in Chicago that maybe...
Small. Most people haven't heard of it.
Probably not.
You can't even find it on a map.
I wish that school had some esteem, you know?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Chicago's so awesome this time of year, though.
I think it's awesome almost every time of year. Maybe not January.
January and February, I would not want to be in Chicago.
Yeah, that's it. He's professor of law there, specializing in investment funds and corporate law. Previously, he was a professor of law at Chicago Kent College of Law. This guy was born in Cork, Ireland. You can't do your Irish accent.
Good day, mate.
He's got one, which is funny. Every time I try to do an accent, it always turns into somebody from India. Every single time I turn into an Indian accent. He came to the United States to attend Duke University and this other little school called Harvard Law School.
Never heard of it.
Where he served as managing editor of the Harvard Law Review. How about that? Bert Thistle lives in Chicago, and now he's down in the basement talking about Empire of the Fund, our relationship with the things we use to retire. Say hello to Professor William Bert Thistle. And Professor William Bert Thistle joins us in the basement. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Joe.
I'm glad you can include us on your worldwide tour for Empire of the Fund.
It's very gracious of you. I'm very happy to.
Well, I'm excited by this topic, and I want to read to you from the introduction of your book, which says, over the past 30 years, America has embarked on a grand experiment, perhaps the richest and riskiest in our financial history, to change the way we save money. The hypothesis of our experiment is that millions of ordinary, untrained, and busy citizens can successfully manage trillions of dollars in the financial system dominated by wealthy, skilled, and powerful investment firms, firms that on my occasions have treated investors shabbily. I guess what you're saying is bankers aren't our friend?
You know, not always. I mean, they do a lot of good work for many, many people, but it's hard to look past the last decade or so and conclude that, you know, this is a charitable institution that we're doing business with. Our counterparties are out there to make money, and they will exploit every opportunity that's legal within the market and on occasion outside those bounds. And it would be foolish for us to think otherwise.
I want to ask you about some of the problems, but let's start off with where we were, which was pensions, which meant I went to work for a company. My dad was a General Motors employee, worked for this company for a long time, ended up with this money. So it was service in exchange for this guaranteed paycheck for life. Obviously, we've seen pensions go away. That's where this big black hole has come from that we're trying to fill. Were pensions really meant to go away? I mean, was the writing on the wall for a long time that pensions just weren't going to work as we live longer and longer?
I'm not sure that's what killed them. You know, pensions are a wonderful thing in the abstract. They are a fantastic idea. They solve a lot of problems. They just never seem to work in practice. That is, anytime you guarantee a specific amount of payment, people have all sorts of ways of ruining that promise. So first, people can live longer. That's definitely one of the things that went wrong. But that's not really what I think killed a lot of corporate pensions. I think the bigger problem was that people started racking up much, much more expensive healthcare bills. Because as an actuary, you can figure out how long Americans are going to live and that they're going to live longer. The thing that I think challenged most people's presumptions was that they're going to rack up a huge amount of healthcare bills and that the cost of healthcare was also going through the roof. So again, in theory, pensions are a wonderful thing, but every time we use them in practice, the same story happens again and again. The costs just end up being much more than the promisor can pay.
So we begin dumping pensions, and then for retirement, we start using this wonderful thing called a mutual fund. And we've got some issues there. But before we go into the mutual fund, you quote research at Boston College that reports that for people that are between ages 55 and 64, the median balance in their 401k or IRA accounts is $111,000. So even without the problems of mutual funds, which we're going to dive into, you're saying we're just kind of not good savers.
No, we're not. And actually, I think the more striking statistic is that that's the median number, but a third of all Americans have zero in their accounts. So 111,000 is the median. And, you know, I think to most people, that actually sounds like a pretty healthy sum. Six figures, that sounds pretty good. The problem, though, is that Americans, as you've noted, have a very tenacious habit of just living longer and longer. And if you retire, as the average American does at age 61, and then you sort of permanently retire, you know, late in your 70s, depending on your chromosomal content, it's in the late 70s for males and females. So it's about 20 years. So to get across that 20 years, it's a challenge. And $111,000 annuitized over 20 years comes to just about $7,000 a year. So it's not much when you figure what it's going to pay every year.
No, even without inflation, William, I think if I'm living a $50,000 a year lifestyle times 20 years, my math doesn't look very good.
No, I mean, it's important to point out that Social Security will give Americans a chunk, and depending on which statistics you look at, it can be maybe $16,000 a year or $19,000 a year. So you can include that in the mix. But as you say, even if you add the $7,000 on top of that, you're at a much, much lower rate than you were living on prior to your retirement. And it will hurt, definitely.
I love how you divide the book. You go through anatomy of a fund as if we're looking at a patient, and then we talk about all their diseases and disorders. So, which is always my favorite thing, to get into the muck, you know? I mean, maybe that's me as like a 12-year-old kid at heart. But mutual funds have a lot of diseases and muck, and it starts with fees. A lot of people don't understand these things. Like, we know what we get into, but we don't know the guts of it. So what are the problems with fees?
Yeah, I mean, the guts, it's just like a frog dissection. You know, it sounds great before you get to class, you know, and then you show up in bio and you try to, you know, you try to hold it together.
Not pass out, right?
Yeah. Here's the thing. Mutual funds have a very strong reputation as being sort of pedestrian jalopies that are perfectly suited for every family. But again, you know, the same reminder goes is worth repeating again and again. The financial institutions that run these things are not naive, and they're there to make some money. So they've done, I think one of the most miraculous things they've done is figure out a way to make it very difficult to determine how much you're paying. So if you look in a prospectus, now the thing with mutual funds is you don't get your prospectus until after you've made your purchase. When you do get your prospectus, it's a common prospectus, usually for multiple different funds. And then each of those funds has a separate share class. So if you take a look at the a particular fund from, let's say, J.P. Morgan or any kind of particular company, you might be looking at expenses for 50, 60, 70 different kinds of fund classes. For each of those, then there's a fee and expense table, and you've got to run your finger down the right share class of the right fund. You have to interpret what it means for there to be a 12b1 fee, a management fee, an administrative fee. Sometimes there are fee waivers, which sounds like a good thing, but really all it does is muddy the water a little bit more, because fee waivers can be also waived at any time. So yeah, you start with the simple idea that mutual funds are pretty straightforward and that we can all figure out what the expense ratios are. But then you actually take a look at some of the disclosure, and it turns out to be a very difficult process. And the real tell is that if you look at most fee and expense tables, there's a lot of footnotes. And as an academic, I promise you, footnotes do not equal clarity.
Well, I was going to say, especially a guy in the practice of law, you know that footnotes don't equal clarity.
No. They're there for obfuscation. That's where the bad arguments go to die.
I love this idea. Fee waivers can be waived. I think that's funny too. But when you look at the most egregious fees, the ones that really drive you crazy, what are the fees that are most hidden that drive you nuts?
Well, here's a good one. I was actually just having a conversation with a friend at lunch the other day, and he said, you know, I paid $1,000 or some huge amount for what I'm certain was impartial advice from an advisor. How was it impartial, I asked? Well, because there's no ongoing relationship. There was absolutely nothing, no upside for them to give me the advice, because I was just going to walk away. And I said, so what did they advise you? Well, they gave me a list of preferred funds that would be good funds. Out of the 8,000, here was a list of 2 or 3 dozen. And I said, uh-huh. And how much were they paid to put those funds on the preferred list? And he said, what do you mean they were paid? And that is, I think, the first and most surprising hidden fund for most people, which is when you go to a broker, and they give you a list, a menu of funds that they think are good, better, preferred, whatever it might be, They rarely come out and tell you that they were paid money to put each of those funds on that list. So that, I think, is the most surprising fee. But there's tons and tons of others. You know, remember, a mutual fund is a huge, huge pot of money that's buying and selling stocks all the time. And if you think about the amount of business that's going into that, that's like going to the same coffee shop and spending $5, $10 million on coffee every year. And just like everything else, there's going to be frequent flyer points for being a loyal customer. And I think most mutual fund investors don't realize that those frequent flyer points go to the fund advisor, and they're rarely kicked back into the fund investors.
Right, so they don't pass on to you.
No, so that's just two categories of fees. I mean, I'm not talking about the fees in the table, which I think, even though they're nominally disclosed in the table, can be very difficult to figure out. I'm talking about ones at the very back. Sometimes they're put in statements of additional information, which are, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50, 100-page documents that are not sent to investors but are available online. And you can imagine, they're written by lawyers like me. They're very inscrutable. They're not designed to be clear in plain English. So yeah, those are the two I think that are, I think, surprise most people. 12b1 fees, though, are sort of ones that are a little bit more famous. This is a third category. But this is one that I think bothers a lot of people, because the 12b1 fee is a fee that advisors can charge current investors in their fund to market the fund to other people. And I think most people would say, well, wait a second, if I'm already in the fund, why are you using my money to advertise to outsiders? I'm here. I don't need to be advertised to. And the standard response is, if more outsiders come into the fund, then the fund will get larger, we'll enjoy more economies of scale, everything will be cheaper, and we can pass those savings back through to you. The punchline, of course, is that when the SEC's economist ran an analysis, she concluded that, yes, 12b1 fees are excellent at making the funds bigger and therefore generating more fees to the management, but they're terrible at actually incurring savings and passing them through to shareholders. Yeah, so that's three categories right there.
Yeah, the money never passes on to you.
It does. It doesn't come back. And it's not surprising. I mean, how would you keep track of it? How would you know? It's opaque.
Back when I was a financial advisor, I had some fund families that I leaned on more than others. And sure, one of those fund families was Strong Funds. Mm-hmm. And I was whisked away on an airplane to Wisconsin because Elliot Spitzer in New York was cleaning up funds back in 2006, 2007, I think it was, with a lot of this late trading stuff going on. And he was pointing the finger at Strong Fund. He was pointing the finger at a lot of fund families that were outside of New York. By the way, he was cleaning up the waters of New York and making sure that he had an inside road to governor by pointing out all the funds that weren't based in New York that were causing problems. I think it was more widespread than that. Certainly, I found out Strong Funds was late trading, but hasn't this idea of late trading, which means people letting preferred investors in after the bell has rung at 4 p.m. Eastern, has that gone away?
Yeah, I mean, it was always difficult to do. The two species of malfeasance that came out at the same time from that story that you were describing were both market timing and late trading. Now, late trading was always obviously illegal. There's a 4 p.m. Eastern deadline, and you can't trade after that because it's, as Spitzer said, it's betting on the horse race after the race has been run. So it always required a certain amount of complicity from people within the industry. Sometimes it's like a boiler room in Jersey, you know, gaining and losing order slips after the bell. And sometimes it was actual complicity of the fund companies themselves giving you access, in the particular case there at Spitzer, giving access to the bank feeds right away. So late trading was clearly illegal. Market timing was less so, but the problem turned out to be that most funds had banned market timing in their prospectuses and then allowed it for preferred customers. Uh-oh. But just to get to Strong for a second, Strong is a great story. There's a whole anecdote about his company in one of the chapters because he not only allowed market timing, he did it himself in his own funds.
Right.
And, so he got a lifetime ban and coughed up a lot of money. And that was a real centerpiece in these parts. I'm in the Midwest, and Strong was a big institution in Milwaukee, but it's a quiet, lonely place now in the former headquarters.
That's funny you say that, because they gave me a big song and dance because I controlled quite a bit of money in terms of the relationships I had, which, by the way, is something that investors don't know, too. The amount of whining and dining that Dick Strong did to try to get me to keep people there while the ship was sinking. And I remember leaving and telling my assistant as I'm at the airport, we got to get everybody out.
I got such a nice steak. Something must be terribly wrong there.
That's right. Yeah. When I'm put up in a hotel room that nice, I'm like, there's got to be something wrong because that's just not right. It felt dirty. It really did. I'm kind of embarrassed that I even went, you know. But You go into some alternative remedies that we're not going to have time for today, which is a great reason for people to pick up the book, where you talk about 401ks, IRAs, target date funds, exchange traded funds, money market funds. What I like about all of these, Professor, is that you take all of those and you say these are good, but they also have problems. But I don't want to talk about those. I want to get to the cures just a little bit. Number one is lessons and licenses.
Yeah, I mean, this is definitely going to be a little controversial, and not everyone's going to like the idea. But the idea is this. If you use your 401k to invest in actively managed funds, I propose that you get a license to do that first. Now, again, I'm sure people will say, that's crazy. How dare you put anything between me and my money? And my first response would be, let's take a look at what we're talking about here. We're talking about a 401k plan. It's already an incredibly heavily regulated item. It's a program set up by the government to give you a tax break that might not otherwise exist, and we already do a lot of things to comply with it. So my point is, actively managed funds have very, very high fees, and historically, they just don't perform like they promised to. Almost nobody can repeatedly beat the market. So my theory is, look, require people to get a license, find out some real core ideas on investing right before they join their 401k plan, and then they might have a chance of sticking. So that's the theory behind the license.
But, and just a point on that, if somebody doesn't get their license, you know, I mean, then they can't invest in these things. What do we do with those people?
Well, those people will be stuck, to use a loaded phrase, they'll be stuck in what I think are the best investments. That is, they'll be in the qualified defaults. They'll be in index funds, target date funds, most of the prudent stuff. So all I'm really suggesting is, if you want to get away from the defaults, if you want to get away from the prudent stuff, fine, go through this door. And the license will do, I hope, a couple things. First, it might actually give some warning and tell you a little bit about the fees and the problems with actively managed funds. But second, it will serve as a warning. It'll tell you, look, we license things that we think are dangerous, you know, flying an airplane, getting a gun, marrying people. If you have to get a license, it's at least a little bit of warning that says, look, through this door, there be dragons, so beware. And yeah, if you choose not to do it, or if you try to get the license and you fail, fine, you'll be left with a lot of good investments.
I like that analogy of the car. You have to have a license to drive a car. Why do we just set people afloat with their investment portfolio and say, good luck?
Well, you know, that I think is actually maybe probably the biggest theme in a lot of this work, which is over the last 30 years, we've switched from pensions, defined benefits, to 401ks. And we basically said, look, America, it's your turn. And a lot of Americans say, great, I love being in charge of my own money. But plenty of people also say things like, well, wait a second, I didn't quite want to be the chief investment officer here. I have a day job, I have kids. And we haven't done a concomitant amount of saying, look, here are the tools you need, and here's the education and training you need. So I'd like to see some of that redressed.
What do you think the chances any of that happens?
I think the prospect of the licensing is very low. Although, you know, it's funny. I mean, one thing people say is, well, who would pay for it? And my answer is, the fund industry would be happy to pay, because if the licenses aren't honored, then people wouldn't get to their more expensive offerings.
Right.
So I think, you know, in fairness, I think that's probably a long shot. I think another approach would be a much more reasonable one, which is to open the thrift savings plan.
Which is a phenomenal. It's amazing to me that the federal government has one of the best retirement plans of all.
It is, and it's highly improbable, because for all the you know, the deserved or not deserved reputation for government work. But yeah, the Thrift Savings Plan, it's the defined contribution plan for federal employees. There's 4 million people in it, $400 billion in it, and it's spectacular. It's run by a private firm, BlackRock, so it's not government work. And the rates that people in the Thrift Savings Plan pay are just mind-boggling.
But that does step on free competition when it comes to, you know, people's money and using their own, making their own financial decision.
On the contrary, first of all, you don't have to do it. I'd be opening it as an option, so you can choose in if you think it's a good idea, and you can stay out if you don't. Also, there is competition, because BlackRock is currently the advisor to that. But if I were the government, I would have an auction every couple of years to make sure that the very best, most competitive advisors try to get that business. And they would offer really low rates, they'd offer very high performance. So I think there's capitalism at both ends. You can stay out in the Wild West if you want to, or you can go into this wonderful plan if you want to.
You thinking about running for higher office?
Not at all. I'm foreign born, so I'm never getting too high.
Well, it seems like this year we're accusing everybody of being foreign born, so you might be good.
That's true. Yeah. Got a sounding name, Joe. Where are you from?
That's right. The book is called Empire of the Fund. It's from Oxford Press, and it's available everywhere, I assume.
Yeah, and Amazon is certainly the easiest way.
And the website for more information, empiretheofthefund.com, or we'll have a link in our show notes at stackybenjamins.com. Professor Bert Thistle, thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Everyone, I'm Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and I got to admit, As smart and as good looking as I am, I have not figured out how to turn those two obvious assets of mine into a way that I can afford an ice cream truck. Joe and OG won't fork over any cash. Isn't that what friends are for? I mean, remind me never to give them a helping hand when my ice cream empire takes off. I'll figure it out. But for now, on to the trivia. Here's today's question. Thinking about Professor Birdthistle's discussion on mutual funds, how about this one? When was the first modern mutual fund created? I'll have the answer shortly. But hey, what if I take a look at Magnify Money or SoFi for ice cream truck money? That's an amazing idea. I'll tell you how it goes right after the break.
Time for a quick timeout to pay the bills. And speaking of paying bills, the centerpiece of your entire bill paying and home operating budget is your checking account, isn't it? So why not have a good one? StackingBenjamins.com/Magnify Money can help you quickly compare checking, savings, and credit card options. Magnify Money. How'd they come up with that name? CEO Nick Clemens shares the story.
Well, I spent years working in banking, and every time we wanted to find a way to make a little bit more money, we would get some lawyers in the room, we would add some extra fine print, and that fine print would help us charge more money. And so what we wanted to do at Magnify Money is we wanted to be the magnifying glass to help go through the fine print, find the traps, and make it really easy for people to avoid them and just spend less money on banking.
Head to StackingBenjamins.com/Magnify Money. The magnifying glass that saves people on average $450. We're also happy to be sponsored by SoFi. Find them at StackingBenjamins.com/SoFi. That's S-O-F-I. We've told you before, we tell you all the time about their low rates and flexible terms for student loans, personal loans, and mortgages. But we asked co-founder Dan Macklin how easy it is to apply. How easy is it, Dan?
It's really easy. You go to SoFi.com and apply. It takes about 10 minutes. We ask for a few pieces of information, and then we will approve you or not approve you instantly in the vast majority of cases. So within 10 minutes, you'll know if you have a rate, what that rate is, and we'll show you calculations as to how much money you can save. So that's extremely quick and simple.
That takes a lot of hamsters to spin that wheel, Dan.
Yeah, we do a soft credit pull. We're running your credit in the background. But assuming that everything matches up, then it really is a 10-minute process for you. And then it's an instantaneous approval decision for the majority of folks.
Let's find out right now how much lower your interest rates can be. Head to StackingBenjamins.com/SoFi. That's S-O-F-I.
It's Joe's mom's neighbor, Doug, and forget Magnify Money or SoFi. I saw Big Al, that guy who helped me find Snoop Dogg's favorite brownie ingredient. He was just hanging out in his car down by the empty lot, and he told me that he can give me a 0% loan if I deliver little baggies of sugar around the south side of Texarkana. 0.0%. Are you kidding me? These sugar packets won't deliver themselves, so time to get this show on the road with your trivia answer. Before the break, I asked, when was the first modern mutual fund created? The answer? According to the popular investing website Investopedia, the Massachusetts Investors Trust started the modern mutual fund in 1924. The fund went public in 1928, and a new industry was off and running. Speaking of running, it's time for me to run out and build my frozen empire. See ya!
MFS. You got MFS, right?
I got MFS, right. Yeah, it was 2 decades late.
And by the way, that first mutual fund is still in existence.
Yes, sir.
You can still put money in it. Yep. Hey, thanks to Professor William Birdthistle for coming down to the basement. It's so interesting, this idea that we have to have a license to drive a car. We have to have a license to do a lot of different things. No license to operate your own money.
There's a lot of discussion going on about this right now. Whose responsibility is that education, right? Is the responsibility in the school system? Is it parents? Is it the government's responsibility? I understand his perspective on, you know, automatic enrollment and you got to opt out of having somebody do that for you type of thing. I think about it from the other side of it. I guess there's a gimme and a gotcha to everything.
Think about all the SEC complaints, like to his point. Think about all the, and he didn't say this point blank, but he did say, if we're going to have the government involvement, let's have government involvement in a way that actually makes sense. Because you and I talk about some of the stuff going on with, think about how many SEC complaints go away if we just have a simple test you have to pass before you manage your own money and you just default into the TSP if you don't.
Yeah. Again, I'm thinking about the compliance costs associated with managing that. If I'm a small business owner,
what do you mean?
If I've got an opt-in program, some of my employees that contribute to the 401k because they've participated and they've passed the test, right? And I've got some employees that haven't passed the test and they're going in the TSP, and I got to keep track of both of those. There's two sides, you know. Pick up one end of the stick, you get the other, right? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. Like
said, but
I look at what you're saying, and I totally agree. But then I think about the cost of oversight that we have now that's just moronic that goes away.
Yes.
You know, I mean, there's a cost. Doing what he says also is a cost subtraction.
Could be.
But who knows? But thanks to I love people like this coming on the show, though. Just these intriguing ideas. And I love when he says, no, I don't think anything's going to happen.
Well,
I don't think any of this stuff's going to change.
There's a lot of money built on... Yeah. Fooling lots of people, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, but we need more people like Professor Bert Thistle, who's thinking outside the box, to use the phrase I can't stand.
You're not a big fan of the outside the box?
Let's have a win-win and get outside of this outside the box conversation. How about that? Hey, let's fire up the Quotacy hotline. Why spend time with a boring insurance agent when you know what? You can just head to StackyBenjamins.com/Quotacy and get quotes from 17 of the biggest insurers in the land. And even OG and I have talked about disability quotes before. Well, guess what? You press the easy button, which is the disability button on the Quotacy website, and they will also help you with disability policies. Today's Quotacy hotline call comes to us from our friend Anthony. Say hi, Anthony.
Hey, Joe, OG, this is Anthony from South Carolina. Question for you guys. My buddy just recently had his debit card taken from him and, you know, identity theft type situation. And upon fixing it with the bank and receiving a new card, he asked me, or he's more concerned with, credit implications over some subscriptions he has attached to the card itself. Not the account, but the actual card. He had a few monthly subscriptions that he doesn't mind no longer paying for, but he's concerned that there might be a credit impact. Is there a cause for concern, or are there certain situations where this is something he needs to take care of, or is he good to just let this lapse? All right. Look forward to it. Thank you very much.
It's interesting, Anthony. Thanks for the question. It depends on what the subscription was for. Like, as an example, if it's a utility bill, and Steve Stewart's all over this, by the way, Steve Stewart, our friend who has a great podcast called No Debt, No Credit, No Problems. I always want to say no problem, OG. Turns out it's no problems. But Steve, you got to change that, because I think no problem is better. You know, no problem. But he says...
I'm sure Steve gives a crap what you think about the name of his show.
I know. How silly is it, though, that our utility bill is part of our credit score?
Well, it's not unless you screw it up.
Well, that's what I mean. So that's the type of subscription, though.
Yeah, I was thinking like my Spotify subscription, my Wall Street Journal. So they'll just stop sending you the stuff.
None of that's going to affect your credit score.
No, yeah.
But
what I was going to say to Anthony was that before we got started, that Joe and I, we should be proactive, you know, and really begin with the end in mind, really synergize and think win-win. Maybe we can think outside the box.
I'm going to kick your ass.
And come up with a great solution. Like, it was funny how three of those four went so over, just, you know, you're just sitting there going, doo-doo-doo. I'm like, wait, what's happening here?
Where's it going with this? Nowhere good. I should have known.
Yeah, I don't think you have anything to worry about on the subscription front, you know, a newspaper subscription, that sort of thing. But if you've got, you know, your...
utility bill.
Here would be one that we have going on right now. If you were paying a healthcare bill with your debit card, and you made a payment arrangement and you said, hey, I'm going to pay $100 a month, and then you unked on that, they could throw it in collection.
That, by the way, is a great word, unked.
That tells about probably 5% of the listeners a little bit about my background.
Because
that is parlance that only a certain group of people get.
I don't get it. I just like the way it sounds.
I know.
If you unk on that. But I think
somebody will write in and go, I know exactly I know exactly the word unk, and I know exactly where you wouldn't want to unk. There's one particular place you don't want to get on unk.
I don't want to even know. Let's get on with this though. We're going to have him back on in a few weeks on our fintech segment, but he was on about a year ago, Thomas Smythe from Trim, and it's Ask Trim, and you get it. It now is through Facebook. So it's a Facebook app. But what happens, OG, is they go through and they look at all of your subscriptions that are hooked up to that debit card. And they will tell you all of your subscriptions. They'll ask you if you want to cancel them. So I'm previewing a little bit because he's going to be on soon. But for Anthony, that's exactly just to make sure he gets them all.
You should do that anyway.
Yeah, I would go to Ask Trim just to find out what he's got hooked up there. Thanks for the question, Anthony. Let's move over to the mailbag. Doug's so excited about delivering those sugar. By the way, what could go wrong there? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to tell him?
Did I ever tell the story about the, I think I have, right? The bag of baby powder in Jamaica?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think in your case, it was baby powder.
It literally was.
No, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. In this case, I'm not sure that's the case. But anyway, Doug's was in a hurry, but threw the mail at us. And it appears we have a nice letter from Rachel today. Rachel says, "Hey, Joe and OG, my husband and I both work full time, file our taxes jointly," which, by the way, just as an aside, 99% of the time, that's what you should do. We've had questions in the past. Should I file my taxes separately? And the answer is going to be you have almost no incentive to ever do that. "Last month, I started a part-time job where I'm paid as a contractor and no taxes are taken out of my check. I'm finding conflicting information about whether I'm required to file quarterly taxes. For reference, my full-time job pays just under $100,000 per year, and I make approximately $1,500 per month at the part-time job, which I started in June. My husband makes around $115,000 from a full-time and per diem job. Last year, we overpaid significantly and received a federal and state refund in New York. This year, we reduced our withholding, but are purchasing a home, so at least I don't plan to owe anything extra. Am I required to start filing quarterly taxes this year, having only earned during the third and fourth quarter since it's a part-time job, and I have significant tax withheld from my primary job? Do I have to file at all? If I do file quarterly, how does this impact my yearly filing as well as filing with my spouse? Thanks so much. Keep up the good work. I'm not learning a thing." That's fantastic, Ray. It's amazing that Rachel would learn nothing from us and still ask a question like that.
Yeah.
But I'm with you.
So this is a great Ask the CPA question. Who's our CPA friend in Arkansas?
Yeah, Deanna.
Great referral to her. And I'm sure that she can answer it as well. I believe the answer is this. and in the spirit of trying not to teach you anything, I'm not even going to bother looking it up to see if I'm right. So, you know, take it or leave it. I believe, though, that if you sit down and estimate your tax bill for the year and you look at that and say, hey, we're going to be even money, or we're going to owe a little bit, or we're going to get a little bit back somewhere in that neighborhood, I would not worry about sending in quarterly estimated payments. Asterisk to that. Your compensation that's independent contractor is going to be subject to self-employment taxes, which means that it's not just looking at, hey, I make an extra $1,500 a month. It's, remember, you have to pay both sides of FICA as being your own boss, basically. So that is going to add tax bill. The best thing you can do, if you have a CPA, just tell them, hey, I make an extra $1,500 a month, self-employment. What do I got to do?
What do you think?
They might say nothing. If you file your taxes with TurboTax, you can just go online and just pull up last year's return, dump in the $1,500 a month and see what it does. Adjust the numbers, put in the house. You know, you can kind of play with it a little bit.
And make sure, if you're doing TurboTax, though, you got to make sure that you list that as self-employment income. So it adds in the additional tax.
Right. Yeah. So just put it as, you know, this is your 1099. And TurboTax, you know, did you receive a 1099?
Right.
Yes. You know, and then ask you to put the number in. So I would say that if you are pretty confident that you're going to be plus or minus, you know, a couple $100, you're going to be fine. Look up, by the way, the IRS guidelines on safe harbor tax withholdings. And the rule for that is, as long as you withhold 110% of last year's tax bill or 90% of this year's tax bill, you're going to be good.
There you are.
Even if you all of a sudden make a huge bonus and you didn't withhold enough, you shouldn't get a penalty as long as you fall into one of those camps.
Yeah, and that's the important point there, OG, is that if Rachel goes under that threshold, there will be a penalty if she doesn't file the quarterly. So
yeah, that's what you're doing. The IRS assumes, unless you tell them otherwise, when you fill out your tax return and say, I made $20,000 last year, or I made $200,000 last year, the IRS assumes you earn that evenly throughout the year. It doesn't know by default when you go to put in your self-employment taxes, or when you go to put in this 1099 income of, you know, 4 months at $1,500 and you put in $6,000, it assumes you earned $500 a month until you tell the IRS otherwise. So there could be a penalty, to your point, if you under withhold, then that penalty can compound because they'll say, well, you didn't send us any money in January right. or April, yeah. you know, and then you have to go back and say, well, no, I didn't earn the money until October. So really, you know, so the best thing to do is either talk to your CPA if you had somebody do it, or go to TurboTax if you do them yourself, and just kind of fuddle with the numbers, and you'll be fine.
There's something else she should talk to her CPA about, which is she should talk to them about the expenses that she has related to yeah. this job. Because really, Rachel, you don't have you're not an employee. You're what's called yeah. an independent contractor, which means yeah. that now the bad news is, like OG said, you've got to pay all those self-employment taxes. But the good news is a lot of the expenses related to the job, you're going to be able to deduct those from that $1,500 that you're making. But you yep. got to find out what those are. So I would ask them that question. How many expenses can I write off? And there was a bigger question around withholding it all, or not withholding it all, filing it all. The answer is yes. Don't file quarterly, but you definitely are going to have to show that.
Yeah, that'll show up on you're going to do a Schedule C as self-employment income is right. where that's going to go. Yeah. And to kind of dovetail on your expense thing, that also opens up a whole world of opportunities from a retirement savings standpoint also.
Good point.
You're self-employed. You can kind of work in conjunction with your main job in terms of your deferral for your 401k and your spouse's deferral and that sort of stuff. So a lot of different opportunities that this, you know, small presents. Pickup job, yeah. you know, this small $1,500 a month deal, which yeah. sounds like a great extra side gig. Oh my gosh.
Nice job, Rachel. If you want to send some of that to us.
Yeah. Go to Amazon.com/ or I guess Stacking Benjamin's.
Or just send it to us.
Yeah, they never do that.
It's so annoying.
5 years we've been asking them to do that one way or the other, and never get a check.
I wish these people were our real friends. Thanks a ton, Rachel, for the question. If you've got a question for us, once again, if you're trying to learn stuff from the show, you're listening to the wrong show. However, if you insist on sending us a question, send those to joe@stackybenjamins.com. If you'd like to be on the Courtesy Hotline, we're getting close again on the Courtesy Hotline where you might be just about in the front row. I think we only have a couple more, OG, in that stack. So that's stackybenjamins.com/voicemail. Very easy for each of those. Thanks also to everybody who's been kind enough to leave us a review. Reviews go on Mom's refrigerator because she's so proud of us. Well, she says she is. I think it's whenever the Bridge Club brings up that we have these two guys in the basement. She's like, no. But you have to read the reviews because the reviews are amazing. And thanks to everybody who's taken the time to read us a review. Here's one that's going on Mom's fridge. 4 stars out of 5 on this one from NORAD918. Great show. Panel often inadequate. That's interesting. Let's read. Absolutely great show most of the time, handling all aspects of topics and guests. Format's excellent. Hosts are great fun. The only issue is the Friday panels often ill-prepared for more complex topics. Certain subjects require experts who understand the research or economics, and the panel members too frequently fall back on platitudes and personal biases with no data to support their views. It's interesting. You know what's funny, OG? This came out right after we talked about basic universal income in Silicon Valley, which we also got a bunch of emails about, and people on Twitter talking to me about that they really didn't like the fact that our panel has just general areas that they talk about stuff, and they really came with the same stuff. Their view of basic universal income was it's not going to work and we shouldn't do it. So, and then I received a lot of research from people that was to the contrary. And now I'm with NORAD here. There are times because people like Len and Paula and Greg are people like you and I, where I think we're kind of a jack of all trades, you know, Our job is to know a lot about a lot of different things.
And knowing a lot about a lot of different things is my specialty.
But you know what that means? There sometimes isn't going to be the depth, which is why I like having...
I think you mean knowing a little bit about a lot of different
things. There you go. Yeah. I prefer a lot about a lot, but anyway.
Well, I know you were talking about me, but...
Yes, of course. But I do think that that's why I like having guests on the round table. I like bringing different attitudes and different money viewpoints. So thanks for the feedback. I thought it was funny. I'm going to compare it with this review. Light and entertaining way to stay up on personal finances. 5 stars from Cozy Maine Life. Hey, Cozy Maine Life. I'm headed to Maine in a couple months. So we'll see you there. This is the first podcast I subscribe to and haven't discontinued in 2.5 years. Each updated version of the show gets more professional, and it's now more than ever a great way to learn about personal finance and stay on top of current events if you're already in control of your finances. My personal favorite episodes are the Friday roundtables, but the shortened interviews as compared to years past, Mondays and Wednesdays are informative as well. That's true, Main Life. We've cut the main interview most of the time. We shoot for 15 minutes. We usually get between 18 and 20, but this is Cozy Main Life. Knows they used to be 25 to 30, and we have tried to speed up the show, trying to keep it under 60 minutes or around 60 minutes as much as we possibly can. And I think it's funny also that their favorite segment is the Friday Roundtable versus NORAD 918, proving again, OG, you're not going to please everybody all the time. Yes, but good stuff. Thanks. Those are going on Mom's Fridge. If you could leave us a review of the show, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts, that helps us find new listeners. Thanks a lot. All right, OG, I think that puts a bow on today's episode. Thanks again to Professor Bert Thistle for being here. We'll have his book in the store at stackingbenjamins.com. Also, coming up on Friday, Harlan Landis from adulting.tv joins us on the roundtable. He also is the man behind the Plutus Awards. So maybe, OG, we can suck up to him a little bit and maybe get nominated this year for a Plutus Award. What do you think of that?
I doubt it. Probably, but we can try.
Probably not. I doubt it, especially since they have that committee that decides who wins Plutus is not him. But they are his creation. He's going to join Len and Paula on Friday's show. You're back here on Monday with us. We'll see everybody either here on Friday or over on the Green Room podcast, which is a separate feed. You sign up for that wherever you listen to podcast. And OG, we'll see you back here on Monday.
This show is the property of SB Podcast, LLC. The show is created by Josal Sehi, produced by Richie Rutter Reese, and engineered by the amazing Steve Stewart. Special thanks to Professor William Birdthistle. You can find his book, Empire of the Fund, at empireofthefund.com or through the link in our show notes. Big thanks to Big Al for the sugary delivery job. Turns out people are way more excited about little bags of sugar than I thought. I kept telling them that if they like this, there's way more down at the grocery store along I-30, and they all laughed their heads off. Weird.
This is fantastic. Professor Birdthistle created a book trailer, and the book trailer is a YouTube video, but it's a verse. So he decided to take Empire of the Fund and talk about it in verse with music behind him. So I thought this would be a great place to play the Empire of the Fund book trailer. This is it. Here we go.
Greetings, citizens. I'm not trying to be funny, but would you mind if I mention a quick word about money, just to get your attention? Spondulics can be wrenching, can set your teeth a-clenching. Hearken, Americans. we've got to talk about pensions. Yes, it's a little personal, and it'll be in your personal, and worst of all, the first of all, are those who can't be versatile. We have to face facts. Saving stacks is a tax, packed with all sorts of traps. So if a quack attacks, hijacks your scratch, act fast, pack an axe, smack back, let me teach you the knack. First, let me inquire, how are you set for cash? I see you perspire, don't you have a fat stash? As the Dow rises higher, brace against a flash crash. Before you retire, avoid any rash splash. But you're still a young one, sleeping on a futon. No cash to run to Caesar with the croutons. All out of fun, forget about the mouton. Fridge is all done, not even got a soups on. You feast instead on loaf of raw noodle, living on bread as a way to save a ruble. Taste buds are dead, we know ramen can be brutal. Never get fed, you're a serf, and times are feudal. When you're going to drown in all your student debt, surely just a clown sweats the future yet. But you got to gaze on money for the long run. We've got a couple of ways, but it won't be funny with the wrong one. For 30 years, we've run an experiment, squirted some tears. It's been more risk than merriment. In our new game, here's the hypothesis. You'll get the blame, unless you're a prophetess. No more pensions, now you do the choosing. Not a lot of tension, till you do some losing. The USA Today is pro the IRA and the 401k. Oh yes, the 401k. Like a test, for the morrow none slay. Do your best or you'll borrow sums, yay. Make a mess and it's not a fun day. We used to have pros to invest the script. Now it all goes into funds you pick. Our new system is defined contribution. Without wisdom, fear, divine retribution. If you do well, my congratulations. But it can be hell with these tribulations. Problem the first, the way mutual funds work. They're not the worst, though some are run by jerks. They've got a real thirst for assets, but they shirk. And when the Dow bursts, they're still eating at Le Cirque. Also, we're bad. We get lots of math wrong, son. Not very rad at investing for the long run. True, but so sad. Our savings look like pond scum. Can run to dad if we get our fiscal gong wrong. So what do we do if the new system fails? Quietly rue and in poverty quail? Or rush to sue for our finances to bail? Let's do neither. Here are my solutions. Use a group lever through a TSP collusion. Then bring the cleaver. Sue to stop fee pollution. It's not fun to be stunned. Let fear of finance be shunned. Nevermore be outgunned. Peruse. Empire of the Fund.